listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Natalie Portman, Bradley Cooper, Colman Domingo, and Pedro Pascal on the cover, along with more stars on the Innerfold Gatefold. This is Vanity Fair, Part B, and this is the annual Hollywood issue. Here's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief, with this month's Editor's Letter. In the photos, Jermaine Johnson, Radhika Jones, and Cord Jefferson attend Vanity Fair's party at Bar Marmont for kickoff awards season, hosted with Amazon MGM Studios. Vanity Fair's Hollywood issue is a tradition now three decades old, one that represents both the culmination of the cinematic season and a look at what's to come. We celebrate films, shows, performances, and the enduring and powerful impact of narrative storytelling in our culture, and we reflect on what's new and exciting and different. We don't take the celebration part for granted. Since last year's Oscars, it's been an excellent stretch at the movies, starting with Anatomy of a Fall's Palme d'Or at Cannes, and keeping the pace through December's Poor Things. From extraordinary debut films by Celine Song and Cord Jefferson to the pair of big swings that made summer's box office portmanteau, we've relished the range and possibility of contemporary cinema, not just in Hollywood, but the world over, and watched the once separate universes of film and television further cross-pollinate with stellar results. The 11 stars on this cover represent a vibrant selection of our on-screen faves, a group of actors also moonlighting as directors, producers, writers, who, as David Canfield observes in his cover story, are joyfully seizing the moment, changing their paths and charting new ones. And we have a portfolio titled The Power and the Glamour, resurrecting a monitor last seen in Vanity Fair in 1998, which shines a light on influential voices in the town, from directors Ava DuVernay and Sofia Coppola to Best Original Song nominees John Batiste and Mark Ronson, to the matriarch of a certain entertainment empire, to the chefs and restaurateurs who keep Hollywood fueled up and ready to go. But there's no way to fit all our Hollywood coverage into a single issue, and we wouldn't want it that way. For one thing, it's multimedia. Gordon von Steiner, who photographed our cover, also directed a suite of videos you won't want to miss. If you've been following Vanity Fair's reporting over the past few months, you'll have read our profiles of stars like Greta Gerwig, Sandra Hüller, and Robert Downey Jr., among others, heard the voices of Colman Domingo, Lily Gladstone, Emma Stone, and America Ferrera on our podcast, Little Gold Men, and enjoyed movie reviews, TV recaps, festival dispatches, and red carpet coverage on VF.com. If you haven't joined us online, subscribe. It's the best way to stay up on the town's biggest personalities and support our journalism in what's bound to be a newsy 2024. Awards season comes once a year, but these days, movies and television are at our fingertips 24/7. Given the caliber of work on display, that really is something to celebrate. Now, here are some of the contributors to the issue, with their photos and their bios. Punch Hutton, Stealing Sunset. I knew it was a compelling story, says former Vanity Fair deputy editor Hutton, of her chilling experience being targeted by one of Hollywood's most prolific thieves. I just never imagined I'd be writing it. Doing so was cathartic, she says, and I wanted to celebrate the heroes who brought justice to the many victims. Philip Montgomery, Deep State. Montgomery, a conflict photographer whose most recent monograph, American Mirror, chronicles historic struggles, had exclusive access to a U.S. nuclear submarine. We traveled through large swells for over 12 hours, he says. Once aboard, we were positioned snugly between tubes containing nuclear ballistic missiles. Lorraine Nicholson, Playmates, a writer and director whose current film, The Princess of Park Avenue, explores the life of a gold digger, Nicholson writes for the first time about her childhood experiences at the Playboy Mansion, where her parents, Jack Nicholson and Rebecca Broussard, were friendly with Hugh Hefner and his wife, Kimberly. Dina Giannini, The Power and the Glamour. Capturing these dynamic and brilliant subjects in meaningful personal environments, whether a film studio in L.A., a backyard in Calabasas, or an art space in New York City, was sublime, says the creative consultant who styled Vanity Fair's Hollywood Power Portfolio. Gordon Von Steiner, the 30th annual Hollywood cover. The Toronto-born, Brooklyn-based photographer and filmmaker's evocative work has been featured everywhere from global fashion campaigns to internet-breaking music videos. This is his first cover for Vanity Fair. Check out his videos with our cover stars at vf.com. Bradley Hope, Fear and Loathing in Riyadh. The London-based journalist who authors the weekly newsletter Whale Hunting about underground worlds of wealth and power says reporting on the high-stakes relationship between Johnny Depp and Mohammed bin Salman has been both eye-opening and challenging. Hot Mike, How Taylor Tomlinson Moved from the Christian Comedy Circuit to James Corden's Old Slot, by Britt Hinemuth, with photograph by Nick Riley Bentham. At 30, comedian Taylor Tomlinson is breaking big with the premiere of CBS's After Midnight, an early hours variety show produced by Stephen Colbert. "It's not me sitting on a couch," says the woman the New York Times recently dubbed the Taylor Swift of comedy. "Instead, it's like a fake, fun game show." But while the time slot may formerly have been held by the Late Late Show, don't expect any carpool karaoke. I can't sing at all. She was raised by a teacher and a stay-at-home mother. Everyone in her family has a sense of humor, but nobody professionally. I might be the one lone psycho. Too young for clubs, she cut her teeth performing at megachurches. At 22, she realized, "I don't think I'm a Christian, and it feels dishonest to do these shows." An off-color tweet cost her a job. "I told my manager, whatever the offer is, don't bring it to me. I just can't do any more of these." As for today, there's a lot to untangle, but no, I am not religious anymore. Her first special, Quarter Life Crisis, debuted a week before the pandemic. Coming back to the stage was like, oh my God, I have an entirely different career now. Every show sold out. This is crazy. She got more personal with her second Look at You, writing jokes about losing her mother and her bipolar 2 diagnosis. "It's darker, but I'm really proud of finally figuring out a way to present all of that." She's been credited with shattering a network TV glass ceiling, but she is quick to recognize late-night pioneers Phyllis Diller, Joan Rivers, Chelsea Handler, and Samantha Bee. "I'm not the first woman. I mean, Lily Singh had her show a year ago. There isn't anyone right now, so I guess I am the one." Stephen Colbert has been incredibly supportive. "It's nice to be told that by somebody you respect and actually believe that you can reach out with anything." For now, Tomlinson is just enjoying the moment. "I've gotten to a place in my career that I thought I might get to by the time I was 40. I've been really, really lucky." Love Story, The Notebook, opens on Broadway this month with music and lyrics by Ingrid Michaelson. Here, she shares her inspirations. The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks, 1996. First and foremost, the source material. "I broke into tears when approached to join the project," Michaelson says. "The story is so wrapped up in love and life and loss, a creative mesh with her own sensibilities. I have lost both of my parents, and that grief is woven throughout the music." Joe Soren's paintings. "The artist's work is so dreamy, but rooted in reality," says Michaelson, "which to me is very similar to our production. I have multiple pieces of his work in my home." Make Our Garden Grow, from Candide, 1956. Leonard Bernstein's simple, beautiful song served as a frequent jolt of inspiration. "It enriches me." Here's what's trending. Holy Grail. Knit, not net. Take inspiration from the wealth of textiles on display at Woven Histories, now on view at the National Gallery of Art. Many fiber fancies abound. In the photo, Ed Rosbach's Damask Waterfall, 1977, one of more than 150 works on view in Woven Histories, Textiles, and Modern Abstraction. Crochet Chasse, Sarah Sherman, Samuel for Lulu and Georgia Rugg, Hermes Limited Edition Lipstick in Rouge, Cinetique and Orange Neon, Louis Vuitton Top, Toast Bird Nester, Loro Piano Sweater, Dior Beauty Rouge Blush in Delicate Pink, Zara Hair Curl Activator, Wales Bonner Jacket, Apple HomePod Mini, Sola Studio Earrings, Hermes Hat, The Row Shoes, J.W. Anderson Dress, Marnie Pants, Bottega Veneta Bag, Anita Co. Bracelet. And from Daisy Shaw Ellis, True Glitz, with photograph by Bobby Doherty. Gucci Jackie 1961 bag in leather with crystal embellishment. When Salvatore De Sarno took the helm at Gucci last year, he set out to minimize the maximalization that had reached an apotheosis under Alessandro Michele. In an otherwise sleek and street-sharp collection, wide, crisp denim, micro shorts, tiny tanks, wool blazers, the crystal embellishments spattered throughout De Sarno's debut were one of the few frivolities. This glittering iteration on the Jackie 1961 design brings classic charm to a house shape. Chandelier not included, but best believe some of the best things are still bejeweled. Desert Menu. As Dune Part 2 brings its epic sandscape to the big screen, a group of perfumes evokes the brusque, beguiling aspects of arid climes, by Laura Regensdorf. My planet, Arrakis, is so beautiful when the sun is low. Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air. Chani, played by Zendaya, says in 2021's Dune Part 1. She makes the desert sound serene, but the ensuing action, continued in this month's second installment, proves its hostility. Sandstorms strong enough to pierce metal rage on, as do battles to control that hallucinogenic spice, which is key to interstellar travel. According to Dune author Frank Herbert, spice smells like cinnamon, the film's production designer Patrice Vermette says. The real-world locations Vermette scouted are just as evocative. In Abu Dhabi's Liwa Desert, blazing sun softened to fog at night, when the level of humidity in the air made the smell of salt explode, he says. By contrast, the plant life in Jordan's Wadi Rum was surprisingly abundant, but cleverly hidden by the dune crew. One day, rain halted filming. The water had not only amplified the colors of the rock formation, but also the scents of sage, thyme, and mint. It made the landscape look even more out of this world. A crop of new fragrances aims to bottle such high-contrast terrain. Lowe's Vulcan centers on the Spanish rock rose, a flower known to spring up after wildfires, joined here by a Mediterranean bouquet, thyme, lavender. Ioned, a desert-inspired skincare brand, debuts a trio of scents, including Metamorph, a blend of underbrush, cedar, and incense that evokes the rain columns of lightning and darkness that sweep over the land, says co-founder Porter Yates, a Santa Fe native. Hermes Oud Alizan pairs the Middle Eastern note with delicate rose, while Memo Paris imagines Turkey's Cappadocia as a saffron sunset, says co-founder Clara Malloy, likening both the rocky scenery and myrrh-spiked scent to a Dali painting where everything goes soft. The interplay of past and future figures into Amouge's Jubilation 40 with frankincense, long traded through Oman, alongside tobacco and evergreens. Francis Kirkjian, Dior's perfume creation director, also spotlights frankincense in his No Florals new look, but he shrugs off history for pure mood. He says he was wearing super elegant sweatpants by Kim Jones when he started on the scent, cashmere and camel hair, conjuring plush adventures. Aramida Diop writes on books, City Folk. These narratives paint a rich portrait of a glittering, communal, and bygone New York City. In the photos, Love Language, Grace Jones, Keith Haring, and Andy Warhol at Paradise Garage in 1986. Madonna and Haring in November 1989. New York, New York. The city that never quite got over its 80s era, its Club 57, or Studio 54, its graffitied subway system, Warhol or his films, St. Mark's Church in the Bowery, Grace Jones clad only in Keith Haring's squiggles, a cast of characters, sometimes mononymous, always prolific, and too often short-lived. In Radiant, published by Harper, one of several books this spring that take on the glam and tumult of the decade, Brad Gooch traces Haring's defiant, definitive lines. There's his entering a 15-foot by 3-inch Fantasia into his Kutztown, Pennsylvania junior high school student art exhibit. Parsing Haring's youth feels relevant. The image of the radiant baby would become his signature through his 1978 move to New York City to attend the School of Visual Arts and his finding community amid a band of lost boys. In Jennifer Clement's forthcoming The Promised Party, published by Canongate, the author of the acclaimed Widow Basquiat describes that downtown Manhattan cohort. All of us were some sort of runaway. Of Haring, she writes, Keith had tenderness in him, the tenderness that one finds in jails and hospitals. Meanwhile, Cynthia Carr's Candy Darling, published by FSG, the first biography of the glamorous queer icon, serves as a temporal prequel to the scene. Darling starred in the Andy Warhol-produced Women in Revolt, 1971, and Tennessee Williams' play Small Craft Warnings, 1972, long before Haring enrolled at SVA. The meek, the castaways, the othered, the artist, and lovers did not inherit the city. See the well-off transplants who bemoan what little of New York's original grit lingers in her streets. Still, their barbed beauty lives on. At last summer's Blue Note Jazz Festival, 75-year-old Jones beguiled a new generation of New Yorkers in a 50-foot dress that winked to Haring. This April, Madonna closes out her The Celebration Tour, and Gagosian L.A.'s Made on Market Street opening this month reminds us that Jean-Michel Basquiat and his art were bicoastal. Prescient Darling captured an era of yearning in one of her many diary entries. I wanted to be beautiful. My friends told me I was beautiful. I lived to be beautiful. Shelf Serve, trenchant novels, facts scarier than fiction, poignant memoirs, and more, as reviewed by Keziah Weir. Starry Field, in this immersive, erudite memoir, Margaret Juhaili unspools her long-buried family history. Centrally, her grandfather's imprisonment in Japanese-occupied Korea, published by Melville House. James, Percival Everett, author of Erasure, adapted as American fiction with virtuosic wit, presents a spin on the adventures of Huckleberry Finn, as told by Jim, who's trying to free his family from enslavement, published by Doubleday. Who's Afraid of Gender? Judith Butler takes on the demonization of gender in this absorbing deep dive, arguing that the phantasm of gender fear obscures genuine threats, climate change, authoritarianism, published by FSG. Great Expectations. David, a presidential campaign fundraiser for one Illinois senator, considers life, music, God, sex, the gulf between hope and reality, in Vincent Cunningham's resonant debut, published by Hogarth. Nuclear War, based on interviews with 47 named sources, from CIA officers to physicist, Pulitzer Prize finalist Annie Jacobson lays out the terrifying hypothetical scenario of a nuclear attack on the USA, published by Dutton. The House of Hidden Meanings, RuPaul's evocative coming-of-age story, traces his childhood in San Diego through to drag, drugs, lust, love, and eventually sobriety in 1980s Miami, published by Dye Street. Wandering Stars, and Tommy Orange's formidable follow-up to There, There, Orville Redfeather finds uneasy solace in pain meds after a shooting. Over 150 years prior, his ancestor contends with a Sand Creek massacre, published by Knopf. The Extinction of Irina Rai. Translator Jennifer Croft sends up her vocation in this waggish literary mystery. A famed Polish author disappears, much to her devoted translator's horror. Published by Bloomsbury. My Stuff, Bold and Beautiful. Everything's bigger in Lisa Eisner's world, from a gloriously sculptural jewelry line with the Row to her feathered coats and giant ferns. Style File, Everyday Bag, a crossbody by the Row. For glamour, Stacia Lang makes the most beautiful feather coats. She has made me some amazing pieces. Feathers are pretty glamorous. I like looking like a bird. Evening Wear, my 22-carat gold nugget shoulder dusters. They are very Picasso. On Beauty, Holy Grail. I love Retrieve. The revitalizing eye concentrate skin hydrator is the best. Facialist, Terry Lawton. Moisturizer, Le Grand Crème by Biologique Recherche. At home, slippers, Quaddy Sheepskin. Aroma, I use my custom quartz forest oil scent by Loewe Duvier in their home diffuser. Lighting, Barry Zipperstein. On the table, Peter Spelopoulos for Commune Leather Placemats with thick linen napkins. In the garden, anything the landscape designer Art Luna tells me to buy. I have so many beautiful specimens. My giant Australian tree ferns are my favorite. Gardening gloves, hand lady. For pleasure, reading, I went down a Larry McMurtry rabbit hole and listened to all of his books. There are so many characters to love, especially his women. To unwind, Normatech compression. Working with, black jade. It looks so dramatic and feels like cashmere. In collaboration with Mary Kate and daughter-in-law Ashley Olson, I made earrings, bracelets, and rings, plus necklaces in very primitive organic shapes, like talismans. The menu, morning cup, Alice Waters told me about Chinese pear tea by Imperial Tea Court. Now I drink it every day. Superfood, Erewhon Medicinal Super Immunity Bone Broth. Dining out at the Beverly Hills Hotel Polo Lounge. I get the McCarthy salad with fries. And this from Daisy Shaw Ellis, Snappy Dressers, photographed by Bobby Daugherty, which shows Chanel bag, Louis Vuitton pink trunk bag, Judith Lieber couture camera flash bag. Perhaps it was prescient timing for Hollywood's biggest night out, and some nostalgia for the era before smartphone pics that prompted this season's crop of objet d'art camera bags. Clever details, including a makeup mirror hidden behind a faux lens protector, Chanel, and a removable strap, Louis Vuitton, infuse the fanciful with the practical, though no actual camera function. Get ready for your close-up. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Jodie Foster. The two-time Oscar winner and star of NIAID and True Detective, Night Country, on family, fantasy, football, and fancy sheets. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Watching a great movie in the afternoon and then taking a long nap. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? War, but also a world without sugar. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My boring hair. Where would you like to live? In a treehouse, just above the ocean, but with nice bougie sheets. What is your most treasured possession? My box of Christmas ornaments. What is your greatest fear? Naming my greatest fear, because then I'll have to admit it, won't I? Which living person do you most despise? Any dictator scheming to end a democracy? What words or phrases do you most overuse? Howdy, wow, and the F-bomb. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My wife Alex and our sons, Charlie and Kit, of course. What is your most marked characteristic? I will use any excuse for an over-the-top holiday celebration, whether the day is real or imagined. When and where were you happiest? Watching my sons ski down a mountain for the first time. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? We would all be rugged, self-sufficient, and capable. No one would complain or pick up their phones because, you know, chopping wood and stuff. Which talent would you most like to have? Playing piano so that everyone could gather around and sing their favorite songs together. What is your current state of mind? Guiltily eyeing time alone to do absolutely nothing. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I would just be content with every moment as it is, instead of gnashing my teeth trying to change things all the time. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? The fat lady in Salinger's Franny and Zoe. What is your favorite occupation? Moving around all my players in fantasy football. Who are your heroes in real life? Isa Lopez, director of True Detective Night Country. She can do it all and be the first one on the dance floor. What do you most value in your friends? Deep and complex thoughts, delivered with a wicked sense of humor. Who are your favorite writers? Toni Morrison, Raymond Carver, Mary Carr. What is your motto? More milk, less moo. What are your favorite names? Ginger, Bubba, Georgia, Bananas. How would you like to die? Consciously, filled with curiosity and awe, hopefully in front of a big picture window. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Jodie Foster. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.